There we go. He knows that I'm with energy. So, we're missing out. We've gone from the sort of medieval period and the flowering of Hindu traditions in the medieval period, the Chola dynasty and the flowering of Shaivism. And that lasted right up to the... it began to decline about the 12th, 13th century, and then you get the Mughals coming and the Mughal power in northern India, but you still get the Hindu kingdoms in the south, particularly Vijayanagara is important, and these almost tantric kingdoms, really. And then the East India Company starts to make way in Bengal and establish itself there in the 17th century. And 100 years later, you've got the establishing of the East India Company in that region, and there's a power struggle after the decline of the Mughals in about 1720, particularly with the French and the British.
I'm sorry, the East India Company, that confuses me sometimes. There was a Dutch East India Company and an English one,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And was it just those two?
Yeah, there was a Dutch... There wasn't a French East India Company, but there was a Dutch East India Company, and there were rivals. Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. So it was the English one, obviously.
Yeah, and the English one won out in the end.
Okay.
And the Nawab of Bengal was... felt threatened by the British on the one side, and then you felt threatened by the Afghans, and you were worried about Afghan invasions as well, so the whole thing was collapsing, really. And there was the Battle of Plassey. There was I couldn't remember the history fully, but you can read about this in any standard history of India, whereby the there was a conflict over Calcutta. I remember as a schoolboy, they were telling me about the black hole of Calcutta. Do you remember that? Used to tell us this. It was a mistake, actually. It was I think it was the Nawab. I can't remember his name now. Ramesh, do you remember his name?
No, I can't.
No, I'm sorry, my history is a bit vague. He captured Calcutta and put about 127... prisoners of war in this small room, and as a consequence, most of them died, other than about 20 of them. It's called the Black Hole of Calcutta, but it was an error because I don't think he had realised the conditions under which they were being held. But anyway, so it was a kind of mistake in a way. But because of that, there was it caused a strong reaction. And Clive of India, who you see there, very august-looking gentleman. Had a deal with some of the army of the Nawab of Bengal, so they had this big battle and the British were outnumbered, but because they'd done a deal with part of the army, they were just going to stand there and not do anything. Anyway, eventually they won the Battle of Plassey in 1757, and there were French as well. The Nawab sided up with got the French on board as well, but the British won this battle. And it was a very important battle because it established the supremacy of the East India Company in that region, against the Dutch as well. And it's established the beginnings of British power in India, or the British Empire in India. And the French, after that battle, never got hold again. They never got in, apart from Pondicherry. There was also the British besieged Pondicherry, and the French besieged Madras, and all sorts of those kind of... It was a part of the Seven Years' War, to be honest. The Seven Years' War in Europe got extended out into India. And British power was at its height in the mid-19th century. That picture is a picture of the end of the Battle of Plassey with the British and the... And I can't remember his name, but the one who had capitulated to the British and sided with them and not fought in the battle. So you get this rise of nationalism in the 19th century also. With as British power rises, you also get a rise of nationalism in the beginnings of the 19th century, right the way through to the kicking out the British in 1947, 100 years later. So the rise of nationalism is linked to the Hindu revival or the Hindu Renaissance. Now this Hindu Renaissance is characterised, what's called the Hindu Renaissance, is characterised by an emphasis on reason to establish the truth of the Veda, as a rejection of images as idolatry, a rejection of caste, rejection of child marriage, rejection of widow burning, sati, and the construction of Hinduism as an ethical spirituality. So that all occurs at the beginning of the 19th century, and throughout the 19th century, really. So it's an attempt, in the context of colonialism, to reassert Hinduism as a national force.
This was before people started translating the Vedas and the Upanishads into English.
It's about the same time. Yeah, about the same time.
Okay.
So the earliest translations were Jones in the 1780s or 90s.
Okay.
And then Indology starts. You get German Indology departments established, Bonn, places like that, Leipzig. And you get Mollier Williams here at Oxford in the end of them, towards the end of the 19th century. But throughout the 19th century, you get these chairs of Sanskrit established throughout Germany. And so in the Mollier Williams dictionary, he says there are 44 universities in Germany. No, sorry, Landen's Rest Sanskrit Reader. 44 German universities are teaching Sanskrit by the end of the 19th century. I think they're coming out now.
So how did that happen? Why did they take such interest, the Germans?
Because of the discovery that Sanskrit was cognate with Greek and Latin. And so the Germans didn't have colonies, but they had deep intellectual interest in India. And part of the German Romanticism as well, Schelling and the Schlegel brothers. They were deeply influenced by these Upanishadic ideals.
But this rejection of all these things which is there seems to me as if that is a response to the Christian authority and the kind of colonial influence which was there.
I think that's right.
So I mean it was a kind of exchange which was taking place, which we were not really discussing this morning in the seminar.
I think that's right. There's a response to Christianity. Yeah. It's an attempt to model Hinduism.
Model Hinduism.
On Christian.
That's right.
Shape of Christianity. Yeah, very much so. And it's although it's a kind of rejection of colonialism in a way, it's actually capitulating colonialism.
That's right,
because you're shaping yourself in the shape of the colonizers.
Yeah.
You're imitating them. Now, one of the main figures here is Ram Mohan Roy, 1772 to 1833, and he's sometimes called the father of modern India. And he's a Bengali Brahmin family. And he's a highly educated man. He's educated at Muslim University in Patna, and he's has Sanskrit degrees from Varanasi as well. And he has a job. He gets a job in the East India Company. But I think he married a wealthy widow or something. I can't remember now. But he died. He retired wealthy in 1814 to devote his life to religious reform. And he visited Queen Victoria, and he dies in Bristol. He catches a flu or something in Bristol, and he's buried in Bristol. The place was too cold for him, really. Like the cold. No such heating as it.
Can I just ask a question? You know, when you say rejection of images as idolatry, is this a rejection of Murti, Puja, all of that? But that came back then, later again.
Yeah, it never disappeared, really, but this was the intellectual elites of Bengal saying, this is a load of nonsense. So they started to try to create new forms of worship based on, like, hymn singing, really.
Yeah, and this was like the Arya Samajis, or was it?
Arya Samaj, Brahma Samaj.
A bit like Low Church, maybe?
A bit like Low Church, yes. Unitarians.
So when was Max Müller doing his work? That was later than that.
Late 19th century, yeah.
So that, okay.
Yeah, he's around the sort of like 1880s, 90s, I think. That's a bit later.
Okay. And both streams continue to coexist, don't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Like
even
all
today,
the others.
Yeah. That's right, even today. You get lots of sort of respectable Hinduism is derived from this, or middle class kind of intellectual Hinduism is derived from this kind of orientation, really. So Ram Mohan Roy, his claim was that God is transcendent, immutable being, pure being, influenced by philosophy, the creator and the creator. So a lot of Christian influence there. They're very influenced by the Unitarians and something called deism. Mm. And all religions differ only in essentials. Religions are one in essence. This is a very common theme in modern Hinduism, that all religions are one, paths up the mountain to the same God. And it's not that that's unknown in earlier Hinduism, but it's not thematized to such an extent. So even in the Bhagavad Gita, you get you come to me through many different routes and that kind of thing.
This is very unique to Hinduism, isn't it? This inclusivity.
That inclusivity is unique to Hinduism, yeah. But it's highlighted in the 19th century. The earlier traditions were less inclusive, I think, in a way. Shaivism and Vaishnavism were more. So, well, you know, we've got the truth, we'll have an argument with you. So, yeah, anyway, God is known for Roy through reason and observation of the natural world. Very naturalistic theology, really. And the God of nature is discovered through reason. Pure deism. In the 17th century, there was a movement called deism, which said that you can understand God through reason, not through revelation. For people like Herbert of Cherbury, Martin Tolland, thought that you could understand, Locke, John Locke, thought you could understand God not through revelation but reason. Reason takes predominance. And that influences this 19th century form of Hindu intellectualism. What is done through reason, observation of nature. And there are influences here on Roy, the Upanishads and Shankara and Sufism and Unitarianism and deism. Yeah, these are the influences on Ram Mohan Roy. So he read back Unitarian ideals, really, and deist ideals into the Upanishads and Shankara.
I'm not sure. Unitarianism?
Oh, Unitarianism is a kind of Christianity which rejected the Trinity in the 17th century.
Okay.
That God is one.
Yeah.
And it exists today in it's still very dominant in Wales.
And the United States.
United States, especially, yeah. And it's all linked up with New Ageism now, I think, in various ways, you know. It's a very tolerant, very open kind of church. But they went to the state, I think they got kicked out or whatever, yeah. Or pushed to the Celtic fringes. So the whole valleys in Wales which are Unitarian churches, you know. So the aim then for Roy is to purify Hinduism of superstition, what he calls superstition, such as idol worship, karma and reincarnation, and through returning to the teachings of the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras, which he thought didn't contain these doctrines, and were purified Hinduism. And reason leads to universal ethical codes, which is pure deism. And he wanted the abandonment of widow burning and child marriage. He rejected child marriage because that was a practice. Didn't mean that you lived with the kids got married. I mean, that, you know, you married these kids when they were 5 or something, and then when they got to 16, they go and live together as man and wife.
Unfortunately, it's still happening today.
Yeah, it still happens
in the lower castes.
Yeah, that's right. Still child marriage. Yeah. And he advocated the abandonment of sati. Sati was a tradition among certain groups of. In Hinduism, where the wife would immolate herself on her husband's funeral pyre. And that was made illegal in 1829 by the British, but partly because of Roy's influence.
But that also still exists, doesn't it?
It still exists sometimes, yeah. There was a revival in the 1880s, Rukh Kanwar. And there's a big debate. There's an interesting book by Hawley called Sati. And Julia Leslie wrote an interesting article on called Sati or Sati. But Sati is spelled S-A-T-I with a long I, or Sati, S-U-T-T-E-E. In which she tried to look at Sati from an indigenous perspective, from the, was not only morally condemning it, from the Sati perspective. So you get these Sati stones, which are stones with hands on, which, because the person who, the woman who becomes a Sati means a good woman. The woman who immolates herself like that becomes a goddess and brings merit on the family and good karma and so on, and possibly wealth. So Ruth Kanwa was in 1983 or whatever it was, she was about 18 and her husband was 19. He was a medical student. They were quite educated, really. And he died. The husband died. I can't remember that. Some illness. And she immolated herself on the husband's funeral pyre. It was a big...
I just had an insight when you were talking about that, because a husband becomes God, isn't it? The channel tool.
Yeah.
You touch the husband's feet. So when the husband, i.e., your connection to God, goes, you sacrifice yourself. It's probably the sort of highest swaha.
Yes, it is. It's according to that indigenous perception. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a big debate whether it's murder or whether there's a it's voluntary. But anyway, it was made illegal mainly due to Roy's influence. And he founded the Brahmo Samaj in 1828, which is like a Christian reform movement, really. They had regular meetings and they used to sing hymns from the Upanishads. And it's still carried on. I think it's still a Brahmo Samaj. And there are two figures after Roy's death, Devendranath Tagore, who is the father of the poet with a big beard, and Keshav Chandra Sen. There's some controversies about Sen and so on, but anyway, so it still carried on after his death. And they didn't succeed in reforming Hinduism, in a sense. The popular Hinduism still worship icons and so on. And another group, the Arya Samaj, founded by Dayananda Sarasvati, he was, again, from Gujarat. He's from a Shaiva family, quite a devout Shaiva family. And one night on Shivaratri, he was with his dad in the Shiva temple, and everyone had fallen asleep on all-night vigil except him. And he saw a mouse, or a couple of mice, eating the prasad, eating the food offered to the deity, thereby polluting it. And then he thought, how could a god allow a mouse to eat the prasad? It's not a very powerful god. So he rejected Shaivism. He must have faith in Shaivism because of this mouse.
There must have been a story leading up to that.
There must have been, So he says to his dad, and he says, how can you know, this mouse eating this? Anyway, they rejected
the final straw.
They final straw, Another, I think his brother died, or his sister, I can't remember now. But there was death in his family, which caused this kind of crisis in his mind, and he wanted to become a renouncer. They wanted him to get married off. They were going to marry him off at a fairly young age, but he ran away from home and became a renouncer. And he found a guru. There he is. Doing his... he looks a bit like Nityananda, another guru in this cover. And he founded the Arya Samaj. It doesn't look really ascetic.
Is this when the guru worship came into play?
It's always been there. It was much older. Yeah, the guru worship does come into play. That was... I'm not sure when the worship... I mean, certainly then in the 11th century, the guru worship. So anyway, he founded the Arya Samaj to promote Hindu reform, and he advocated a return to pure Vedic religion focused on the eternal, omnipotent, impersonal God, a bit like Rama, I agree. And he emphasized this thing called Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana means eternal, eternal Dharma, eternal religion. And many contemporary Hindus take this term Sanatana Dharma, which Saraswati highlighted, and would say that's the essence of Hinduism. This is the true essence of Hinduism, Sanatana Dharma, the eternal truth. So, and there are some temples, I think, now, which are Sanatana Dharma temples, you know. But it's not traditional, it's not it's a fairly new form of Hinduism in a way.
But they also claim that the Sanatana Dharma is the root of all religions in the world. Is this true?
No. Not historically. It might be metaphysically true if you're being...
Historically.
Is it similar to Advaita Vedanta?
This is a bit like that, a bit like Advaita Vedanta, yeah. Yes, because it's oneness, it's this unity, the unity. It's very strongly influenced by that. And this theme also feeds into the later Vivekananda, who we'll look at in a second. So the rejection of the epics and the Puranas, all these stories of the gods and all that, which he thought, so that's all nonsense. It's a kind of rational religion again, a rejection of idol worship, rejection of the avatars, the incarnations of Vishnu, and a rejection of pilgrimage. All these fundamental things so fundamental to the popular practice of Hinduism, are rejected by these sort of intellectual movements that wanted to purify, strip Hinduism down. It's a bit like Protestant reformers, I suppose.
But Vedanta wouldn't have rejected the epics and the Purans, would they?
No, that's true. Okay. That's true. Yeah, the Vedanta tradition doesn't reject that. Yeah.
These people will kind of go back to the idea of fire worship, because the main kind of ritual is based around the havan.
Oh, yes.
And doing, you know, these fire rituals with the Daiti Mantra and things like that. So there are no kind of idols or, you know, images which are kept there.
Yeah.
But some of them do keep you know, idols and images, but mainly it has to do with the fire worship.
Right.
Which goes back to what you're saying here, Vedic religion.
Right, so he went back to that. So he kept the fire ritual, isn't it? Just
that's the central part of it.
And they call it scientific, don't they?
Yeah.
Because the mantras, if pronounced in the right way, resonate with celestial, geometrical vibrations.
Right.
So, and it's very exact.
Yeah.
And there is no bhakti in it, I don't think. That was added later on.
Yeah, there is no bhakti.
Very precise.
It's just, if you go to an Arya Samaj place, the program for the day would be, you know, havans and rituals and chanting of the mantras. And then, of course, they would have lunch or dinner or something like that.
Oh, so, but rejection of bhakti.
Rejection of bhakti, that's right. Yeah.
Apart from the Abhisheka, which is a sort of puja on the...
Well, it's not really Abhisheka, but it's like the omas, you know, the what you call the offerings, which are offered to the fire while chanting the mantras. So it's basically just that.
Yeah. Yeah. So they still carry on. I mean, it's still Arya Samaj.
Yeah.
Chandravalli, he does all of this to great excess out in Middleton Stoney.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You have heard of him?
Yes, I think I've met him.
I'm sure you have.
He was there during one of the lunch.
Oh, yes, that's right, he did the lunch. That's right.
He did the lunch.
Well, so they do all that. There we are. You
should take your students there sometime.
We should do that. We used to do that sometimes.
Where is that?
In Middleton Stoney. I can give you details later.
That's really interesting.
There's a temple there, so it goes on this stuff.
If you give me the address, I'll send you the details.
Sorry, I can find it.
Or you can't.
No.
Never mind.
You can't see it.
So the Arya Samaj, he said he thought that again, internationalism, that reformed Hinduism could be a force against Christianity. And he reinterpreted the caste system as Varna, so you get the four Varnas, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the Shudras, and they're not actual caste, not states of society, but they're proclivities of people to do certain kinds of things in life. So you get some people attracted towards the Brahmanical, intellectual kind of life, you get some people attracted towards warrior, martial dimensions, and some people attracted to trades. and some people are attracted to farming and that kind of thing, so artisans. So he reinterpreted this to mean to place emphasis on varna, not on caste, which you still get today in many contemporary Hindu reformers. ISKCON has this notion of varna as well. So there's a reconversion to Hinduism of low-caste Muslims and Christians. The Shuddhi rite, that was terribly important. So lots of low-caste groups are converted en masse to Islam and also to Christianity and also later to Buddhism and Bedkar. But through the Shuddhi rite, the purification rite, you could reincorporate these people back into Hinduism.
Sorry, you said later to Buddhism?
Ambedkar, yeah. Because he was earlier. So Ambedkar is... the 20th century, who's advocates Buddhism, and that's lots of mass conversions of low caste of Buddhism there.
Really? I've never heard about that. When would that happen?
Ambedkar, of Gandhi's time, who was a contemporary
Gandhi. Is that still going?
I think it's still going, so I'm not sure actually. Ambedkar's successors, they must be there. They just become. You become a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist, you just become a low-caste Buddhist or a low-caste Christian from the perspective of the Brahmins, you know. So the Arya Samaj is still present, especially famous for schools. It's very good in education. And it feeds into a nationalist politics, but it's not such a strong nationalist politics as the Hindutva or BJP or something like that. It's an earlier form of that. But it links Hinduism to nationalism. And wants to purify Hinduism as the Brahma Samaj did, of what it calls superstitious elements. Now, another important character, not so much a reformer, but his followers are reformers, was Ramakrishna, who was 1836, who's a mystic really, and he's born to a Vaishnava family, and they marry him off when he's young. I think he's about 14 or something. And he became a priest of the Kali temple at Dakshineshwar near Calcutta. But he was prone to ecstasies and trances. He used to go into these ecstatic states. And he had inner visions of Kali and these trance-like states which were called Samadhi. And he had various teachers, a tantric woman called Bhairavi and a naked Advaitin, Totapuri. These were two teachers of his. And he's said to have achieved this Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the Samadhi without thought construction. And he had visions of deities, and he had his cousin or his brother, I can't remember, that took over the running of the temple, because he became incapable of doing the pujas and all that which were required at the Dakshineshwar temple. Because he was so out of it.
Out of it.
Yeah, exactly. There are stories of he would be just sitting and talking to the devotees, and the devotees would mention the name of Kali, and he would go in a trance.
Yes.
And he would go in a trance when he was doing the puja and all this kind of thing. So he kind of became incapable of doing the puja.
So they wheeled him out and called his brother or his cousin.
But apparently, he was capable of. Embodying all different religions, and he was very much into the mother, into Dvaita, but he also could fully comprehend Advaita tradition, but because he loved the form of the mother, he ended up in this bhakti, total love for her, but he could slip in and out of all the different ways.
That's right.
He must have been such a character.
He was a real character, yeah. And he used to go into Samadhi with his fingers like that. I've got a picture of him. And then his followers would come to hold him up with his four over.
Probably we would call someone like, would send them into the psychiatric?
Yeah, they send him to psychiatric hospital.
In this day and age. Mm-hmm.
They would, And but yeah, it's always, give me a drink of water, he'd say. They go and get me a drink of water. He said, I don't want it. I just wanted to want something. So it should stay in his body.
He would go into a kind of catatonic state.
Yes.
And he would not even...
That's what they call it here, catatonia.
Wake up from that state.
Yeah. So he's the all religions are one. Because of his, he said he experienced the gods of all the world religions, and so therefore knew experientially that they were all one. And Kali and Brahman are different aspects of a single reality. And there he is. Toothless grin he's got. There's another one with a grinning, he's got a gap. And that's Bhavatarini Kali, who is the form of Kali that he worshipped in the Lakshmishwar. There she is on the corpse of Shiva, standing on the corpse of her husband Shiva. So that's the icon that he did puja to and worshipped, which is still there. And there he is in going off into Samadhi.
Taking off. So that's how to do it.
Being supported by it. I often wonder if this is a posed photograph. He's looking there. And that's his wife. Oh, yeah, when he was. He ended up in Dakshineshwar temple. They had married off, and his wife, when she got to 16 or 17, walked from their village to the temple. And she said, "I'm your wife, you're married to me."
And he was much older, wasn't he?
He is much older, yeah. About 10, 15 years, I think.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's bad. And then she thought, "Oh, am I married? Oh, dear." So she devoted her life, long suffering. Wife devoted her life to Ramakrishna, really. And they became, there's an apotheosis of them, and they became deified. So in Bengal, you'll get pictures of Ramakrishna and Sharada Devi together. It's like Shiva and Shakti, or whatever, god and goddess. So she became herself a very important and powerful figure. But she looked after Ramakrishna. And then they had, he started to attract disciples. When the flower blooms, the bees come, as they say. Vivekananda was one of the most important attractions for internet. For some reason, the middle classes in India were attracted to Vivekananda. And one important character, Narendranath Datta, who became Swami Vivekananda, was influenced, strongly influenced by Ramakrishna, and had various religious experiences with him. So there's one account of Ramakrishna putting his foot on Vivekananda's chest, and then Vivekananda goes into Samadhi. He must have been lying on the floor, I don't know.
Is he the guy that went to the Chicago?
Yeah, that's the one.
The same guy?
That's the same guy. Yeah.
1893.
That's it. Yeah. And he had various visions. He wandered around India after Ramakrishna's death. And he had a famous vision on Cape Corrin, on the very tip of India. It's an island just off the tip. And he was meditating there. And he had this vision of a united India. And the vision of a united India. And they've got a temple there on Cape Corrin. You can go visit it. The day I was there, the sea was too rough, though they stopped on the boat because it was a storm. So I never actually got to go up to the island, unfortunately. Now, he said the divine is in all beings, and seeing this in others will promote harmony and love. That's the basic message of Vivekananda. And he went to the World Parliament of Religions in 1893, where he's like a pop star, really. He really hit a strong note. And he was the first proponent of Hinduism as a world religion. Mm. And he advocated the unity of religions and tolerance. Hinduism is a religion of tolerance. It's a religion of unity, that all religions are one. This transcendent power lies behind it and behind all religions. And he appealed for material support from the West. He said, "We don't want missionaries, but we want your material support." And he advocated the idea that the East is spiritual and the West is material. And that distinction has influenced our perceptions of Hinduism ever since. Mm-hmm. Even Radhakrishnan, over here in the souls, have made that distinction. The East is spiritual and the West is material. He went to the World Parliament of Religions. And he was the host of the Unitarians and also the Transcendentalists. So he was the guest of the wife of Emerson,
Sorry, just to come back to that point that the East is spiritual and the West is material. How did he make such a claim like that? What was he basing that on? I mean, given that.
Yeah. Well, he said the East India had nothing materially, that there was poverty there and so on, but they had this spiritual richness.
Right.
And that the West was spiritually impoverished, he thought, but had material success.
But, I mean, was he not taking into account, 2,000 years of Christianity, or...?
Yeah, he wasn't taking that into account.
Okay. Right.
He probably didn't know much about it, though.
Right.
But you just thought, I mean, his what he knew of Christianity would have been from missionaries, and they probably weren't the greatest representatives of Christianity, I'm not sure. So he founded the Vedanta Society, and he returned to India and founded the Ramakrishna Mission. So he stayed in Europe as well, I think. So he's unusual because he left India, which was polluting really for him. And he emphasized karma yoga, hospitals and schools. And he had this Ramakrishna Society he founded. And they're still going. They've got good libraries, good bookshops. The monks, they have monks and nuns. But it's interesting, in the Agyananda Bharati writes an interesting book, autobiography of Guru. Bharati was a German Indologist who became a monk. He wandered around India, wrote this autobiography. And he got initiated, he became a Ramakrishna monk. And he described at the Kumbh Mela, the great festival where all the sadhus parade into the Ganges, the Ramakrishna mission are right at the back because there's a hierarchy. And because they're dealing with pollution, they're dealing with hospitals and polluted, so they're polluted in a sense, so they're lower down in the order of the monks and nuns. So that's quite interesting. And this is called Neo-Vedanta, a new vision of Hindu modernism. So Vedanta is, all religions are one, there's a unified power behind all religions. And there's also a vision of a united India, which is in consonance and harmony and linked into this transcendent power. And there's an emphasis on action, the action in the world, karma yoga. And Hinduism is pluralistic but accepts all religions as aspects of one truth. And this provides a strong ideology to link it into nationalism, because of the diversity of India. Actually, we're all one. Although there's such great diversity, there's a unity, there's a pull towards the centre. So this provides a kind of ideology for a Hindu nationalism. And there's Ramakrishna with some monks. There he is in the middle. And some of the Ramakrishna monks, and we do know who they are, but I don't know who they are right now. So the real sort of power behind for a reformed Hinduism. And then another important character comes along is Gandhi. Gandhi is born in the Gujarat again into a Baniya family, a merchant family, and he has a background. Bhakti background, Vaishnava Bhakti background, with Sufi influence. And he studied law, educated character, as you know. He wrote to Tolstoy, had a correspondence with Tolstoy. Probably gets a lot of his non-violence actually from Tolstoy, but it fits very easily into his Jain influence, Vaishnava Ahimsa background. He met the Theosophists, and he read Edwin Arnold's translation of the Bhagavad Gita. So he said the Bhagavad Gita was the most important book in his life, but he read it initially through Edwin Arnold's English translation. There would have been Gujarati translations, I dare say, as well. He practiced law in Bombay. He went to Africa, and you know the story. He returned to India. He saw the injustice in South Africa and wanted to correct the injustice in India as well. And he had this political vision of non-violence and passive resistance to get rid of the British and realise social change. I'm sure you know the Gandhi story, maybe. And he has an ashram near Ahmedabad, and he emphasises cottage industries such as spinning, khadi, And they're still there, these places. I've got a Carlos Cardi bag or something. There's this famous salt march against the salt tax called the Vision of Taxing Salt. So you could just gather it out from the beach, I think, salt. And there was this famous salt march where they passively resisted the British, who bashed them up with clubs and stuff like that. And this was probably a turning point in the nationalist struggle. And there's he's at the head of the Indian nationalist struggle and a leading voice in Congress. And eventually the British withdraw in 1947.
And yet he's quite a controversial figure, isn't he? Is that because so many died in his marches and...
It's partly because his non-violence emphasis on non-violence and his and he wanted a secular India, a vision of secular India. He didn't want the partition, you see, coming in the middle of this split, but he conceded to it in the end. And then he was assassinated, thankfully not by a Muslim, but by a Hindu, a member of the extreme organisation, the RSS. A sort of Hindu nationalist organisation, really. So a pretty incredible bloke, really. And his God was truth for him, satya, and non-violence, ahimsa, which he's getting from Tolstoy, but also from his Vaishnava and Jain background. And satyagraha, grasping the truth, holding fast to the truth, leads to Indian nationhood, and leads to the welfare of all, the sarvatamdaya. The Udaya, the welfare of Sarva, of everyone. The Sandhya, Sarvatodaya. And he emphasized Brahmacharya, which is self-control, to control the population as well. Celibacy, really. And he reinterpreted untouchability to be the Harijans, the people, the children of God, Hari. But those very groups often reject Gandhi's view as kind of patronising of Gandhi's title. So they call themselves the Dalits, the rejected. The oppressed, sorry, Dalit means oppressed ones. And there's a strong Dalit movement now in India. And untouchability is technically forbidden. And again, he emphasises ethical Hinduism and Varnashrama Dharma, the adherence to your Dharma, which is eternal, with regard to your stage of life, your ashrama, and your Varna, your status in life, where you are in life. So he was against caste in a crude sense, but he supported this notion of Varna that we had before with Sarasvati. That your varna depends upon your proclivity to perform certain actions in society.
Is it non-violence ahimsa? I thought it was ahimsa.
Ahimsa, yeah.
But it says ahimsa.
Oh, it's my... ahimsa, yeah. It's a spelling mistake. Ahimsa, sorry. Yeah. I shall correct that. There he is. He's got quite a cheeky kind of face.
He looks like a proper banya.
Yes, that's right, yes.
It's a typical Banya face.
A typical Banya face, is it? Yeah. But he's kind of got this cheeky grin all the time, isn't he? It's kind of ironic smile.
Have you ever been to his museum in Delhi?
No.
I recommend it. It is profoundly moving. It's fantastic what they've done there.
Right.
The salt march in figures and the whole museum.
Right.
His steps in the concrete.
Oh, how nice. He must have been a very sort of, the presence of him must have been very impressive. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Hindu nationalism, you get this RSS, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak, which is a cultural organisation to promote the interests of Hindus against the Muslims, Christians and communists. And they have very strong influence now, even now, and they sponsor temples and schools, but it's not a negative influence, generally it's a positive influence, and they often get a bad press, but that they do support, like the Kerala, in Kerala they support the Tantra Vidya Pidam, a school to teach tantris. So we've got four lovely families. VHP, again another cultural organisation founded in 1964, and the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a development of the Janat Sangh, founded in 1951, which is a political party to promote Hindu nationalism. And then you get these regional nationalisms like the Shiv Sena with Bal Thackeray. I'm not sure if he's still alive, Bal Thackeray. He's probably quite old now. but these were against Muslims, and you get all this problem of communalism. So the 1992, the Babri Masjid, the mosque in Ayodhya, where the fundamentalist Hindus thought, Ram was born at this place, and so they tore it down. And you get all this violence that you've read about. But it's things have calmed down a bit recently, it seems to me, in India. But it's always under the surface the problem of communalism. And then the use of religious themes, such as Rama, with his bow as a kind of a figure of a virile, heroic Hinduism to unite the Hindu nation. This is partly founded on the ideology of Hindutva, which I haven't actually gone into, which Hinduness, the Savarkar, who was actually imprisoned by the British for about 20 years, but he's a very interesting character, Savarkar. He's kind of an intellectual who advocated this notion of Hinduness. We haven't really got time to go into all of this. And then you get the Hindu diaspora, Hinduism outside of India, and you get the pizza effect, what Bharati calls the pizza effect. So Hinduism gets re-imported back into India. So they export back to young gurus and all that, then it gets re-imported back in. So all these big gurus in India now have often a result of having gone to the West and gone back into India, or yoga gets re-imported back into India. ISKCON, the Indianization of ISKCON. ISKCON started with Prabhupada coming to the West in 1969 and getting a large Western following of disgruntled Western youth, really, who are now old, I guess. And then the Swami Narayan movement in the 19th century. They have strong... Swami Narayan doesn't, but ISKCON has strong Western followings. And Ramana Maharshi, the sage, South Indian sage, who I showed a photograph of some while back. Yogananda, Sai Baba, the one who produces magical jewelry.
And Yogananda's one that always depicted with a really long, slightly feminine looking...
That's right, the Self-Realization Fellowship started that in the States. Rajneesh... L.M. Vital, that's he was a kid when he started, his mother rejected him. Maharaji.
Maharaji.
L.M. Vital, is that his real name?
No, L.M. Vital is the name of the movement that developed after this.
It's
probably still going, yeah. Rajneesh, who died about 10 years ago now, Osho, who was again controversial, a guru who came to the West, attracted a lot of followers. Said you can get enlightened through using the passions, through tantra, through sex, and through violence. You can get enlightened, smashing anger, getting rid of anger. And they kicked him out of America, really.
And he was also, sorry to keep asking, I just want to get which one's which. He was the one that got his followers to give him Rolls Royces.
That's not actually true.
20
of them. But he was actually quite detached from it. I used to know his plumber actually. He used to go to his room, and he had this very simple room, just a bed and a bare room. And he'd be in a state of sort of abstraction most of the time. So he was all these Rolls Royces, I think he wasn't particularly attached to them. And under my email, the hugging guru, who was here, we had somebody at the centre actually who was involved in that, and he said, I get you an appointment to see her tonight, but I couldn't go,
She comes every October.
Oh, does she?
Have another chance.
So, and then Siddha Yoga, which is Muktananda. And they're still big in the West. Chidvilasananda was following on from him. Okay, then you get also Western Hindu teachers who are not Indian, but Avadasa Kalki, Darfri John, you remember him? Eddie
Darfri John.
Lee Lozowick, Jean Klein, there's a whole bunch of them, Andrew Cullen, etc., etc. Well, there's Adidar Navananda. He died about a year ago, I think, 2 years ago. He wasn't very old, he was only 69. He was the one in Maui. Got enlightened when he was in 1973. A bit controversial. His daughter, he's got four daughters. One of his daughters is a film star now. Her surname is Free John. Anyway. And then differences between Hinduism and Neo-Hinduism. You get Neo-Hinduism, continuity with the past is broken. Ideas are generally from Western philosophies and Christianity. And Hindu traditions read or are reinterpreted in the light of these. So that's one feature. Another, Neo-Hinduism is connected with cultural and political nationalism, which is again a Western concept that's taken on Indian Garo. So it's a kind of a mimesis of Western ideas. And the monism of Neo-Hinduism contrasts with the theism of traditional Hinduism. I'm not quite sure about that, but I think it probably does. And the Bhakti is the religion, the masses of people in India. And this is anti-Bhakti. And then the icon is the deity for traditional Hinduism, whereas but a symbol for Neo-Hinduism, if it's accepted. So it becomes a symbol of the divine, whereas in traditional Hinduism it has the energy, the vriya, the power of the Shakti of the divine in it. It is the deity. And Neo-Hindus stress on individual in Hinduism as a spiritual unity. Then there is that dimension traditionally there, inclusivism that Paul Hacker talks about. So it's also a feature of ancient Hinduism there. But those are the main differences and similarities as far as I can see. So, sorry, I've overshot the time.
No problem.